It's 8 o'clock at night. You have a stack of dirty dishes in the sink, a pile of paperwork on your desk, and your kids want you to read to them. Guess what? There's an app for that. Okay, not the dishes, but you can download a children's book app to your smartphone or iPad. Enhanced children's e-books include narration, animation, and interactive features. As NPR's Lynn Neary reports, some kids are getting their very first exposure to books on a digital device.
Michelle Kripalani is deeply invested in Dr. Seuss these days for two reasons. His company, Ocean House Media, has the rights to develop the works of Dr. Seuss as digital books, everything from Green Eggs and Ham to The Cat in the Hat. Kripalani also has a two-year-old daughter, Kentia, who loves Dr. Seuss, especially on her father's iPad.
Boy, she can navigate on that thing. It's incredible. There's something about a child's ability to navigate by touching what they want. And I believe that's the magic here. It's just that the child is able to touch the tree or touch the bird or touch the word that they don't know. And that's really one of the things that just changes everything.
What's that?
The kitty, kitty. Can you touch the cat?
Cat.
Good job.
Meow.
No, Pat.
Kripalani
no.
doesn't consider himself an expert on reading. He began his career as a video game developer. But he says his team was very aware that Theodore Geisel, a.k.a. Dr. Seuss, cared deeply about literacy. So in developing digital versions of books like The Cat in the Hat, they wanted to use the interactive features to help children learn to read.
And as the app is reading the book, the individual words are highlighting. So the child is getting an association between what they're hearing and the actual word that's being spoken at the time. Or they can also touch on any of the pictures, and they get a picture-word association. So if the child taps on cat, for example, the letter C-A-T float up, and the narrator speaks in a clear voice, cat.
With the ebook market so hot right now, a lot of people are eager to get in on the ground floor. Rick Richter left the traditional publishing world to found Ruckus Media, which develops digital versions of well-known kids' books, as well as brand new book apps like A Present for Milo.
What a 2 to 4 year old wants in an app really is to poke and be satisfied and really a very high degree of interactivity. So Milo has 80 different touch points and 125 different animations. And they're randomized, of course, so every time the child enters, it's a different experience.
A Present for Milo begins simply enough with a story about a cat and a mouse.
Who's there, there, there? Milo, that's who! And away they go.
Words appear as the narrator speaks them, and illustrations come alive when touched. A mouse squeaks. A plane flies. A piano plays. Other book apps developed by Ruckus are less interactive, but they might offer other options, substituting a well-known actor's narration with a parent's voice, for example. Richter believes these apps are an entirely new art form.
People ask us, are you creating books? Are you creating games? Are you creating, you know, animations? And the answer is yes. And that's what we set out to do. Books you can play with and games you can read.
But as you might expect, for some, an app will always be just an app.
It's not a book for a number of reasons.
Philip Nell is a professor of English and director of the Children's Literature Program at Kansas State University.
One is that in a traditional reading experience, the reader is in charge. The reader acts on the book. With the interactive ebook, the reader does still act on the book, but the book also acts on, and depending on the adaptation, sometimes against the reader. So I would say that it's not a book. It's maybe a relative of the book, but it's not quite a book.
Nell agrees with Richter that these apps are something entirely different. He says highlighting the words can be helpful to a young reader, but he thinks some of the sound effects and interactive features may interfere with the process of reading.
Reading may be involved, but there's more to it than that, and it's different than that. It's, you know, we don't read a film, we watch a film. We don't read a video game, we play a video game. And I was trying to think, what's the verb to describe what the enhanced ebook experience is like? Is it work? Is it use? Do we play an enhanced ebook?
It's true that some of the bells and whistles in kids' book apps can be distracting, says Elizabeth Bird. She's a librarian at the New York Public Library who's come up with some criteria for evaluating children's book apps. She says it's important that all the artwork and interactive features in an app are well integrated with the story. Obviously, not all apps are equal, says Bird, but the ones that get it right can take a book to a new level.
They allow you to do things that you really couldn't do before. For example, there's a wonderful Peter Rabbit app that's out right now, which sort of turns Peter Rabbit into a virtual pop-up book. And you can go beyond that. I mean, there are apps where you can touch a word, it will pronounce it for you, but it could pronounce it for you in any language. So you could learn a language a second way by using one of these picture book apps.
Bird doesn't believe apps are about to overtake books. She says kids move seamlessly back and forth between traditional print books and digital books all the time. And if a parent wants to use a book app to distract a child, well, Bird doesn't see a problem with that either.
Let's say that I'm in a grocery store and I see a parent handing their phone to their child. Do I want them to hand the child a game like Angry Birds, or do I want them to hand them Freight Train by Donald Cruz in the app form? I would prefer that they hand them the book.
Kids' book apps are so new, says Michelle Cripollani, it's not surprising there are problems still to be resolved. But when he thinks about his daughter, those questions go away.
I just stand back in awe, and I just say, wow, she is just going to be able to absorb so much faster, so much earlier. It's really, really awe-inspiring when you see a, you know, 3 or 4-year-old child that really gets it.
And of course, just like a good old-fashioned book, an app works best when a parent and child enjoy it together.
Kintia, can you touch the puppy?
Pup.
Can you touch the cup?
Cup.
Good job.
Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And for links to download A Present for Milo, The Cat in the Hat, and the other apps we just heard about, visit npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Intelligence agencies have traditionally relied on top-secret information to track changes in other countries, but that did not help them predict the revolutions that have swept across the Arab world this year. In hindsight, it appears they could have found hints of what was going to happen in open sources, online, in newspapers and broadcasts. With that in mind, researchers are looking for new ways to recognize change within societies. NPR's Dina Temple-Raston explains.
Intelligence officials are searching for new ways to understand what motivates people, not just in the Middle East, but around the world. What they're discovering is that traditional intelligence tools can help, but they're limited.
The traditional intelligence community is absolutely biased towards classified information.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Reed Sawyer, a U.S. Army intelligence officer.
I think that open source provides a critical lens, a critical opening into understanding the world around us in a much more dynamic way than traditional intelligence sources can provide.
Open source, newspapers, local radio stations, and of course, Facebook and Twitter. The problem, intelligence officials will tell you, is tapping into all of that in a systematic way. Gabriel Kohler Derrick is an instructor at West Point. He and another researcher at Princeton named Joshua Goldstein think they might have at least a partial solution. They think they can tap into the mood of a country by tracking what its citizens are searching for online. And they can figure that out by searching Google Trends.
What we did was a comparison of search terms over time, starting from the moment that the internet was plugged back in by the government in Egypt on January 25th, and moving forward for a period of about 30 days to see what we could find out.
Google Trends is basically a way of looking at what people are focusing on by mapping their Google searches. Marketing firms have been using Google Trends for some time, and so has the government. Back in 2009, during the swine flu pandemic, Google launched Google Flu Trends. The National Institutes of Health used it to track outbreaks of the disease. It turns out, and this makes sense, that when people started to feel feverish and nauseous, they would go to Google to check out their symptoms. It isn't a perfect indicator, but Google Flu Trends often beat government predictions about flu outbreaks by a week or more. Imagine using the internet to do the same thing with political and social change.
What I think this tool allows us to do is to get a sense for atmospherics.
West Point's Gabriel Kohler Derrick explains its reach.
There are approximately 16 million internet users in Egypt, Now, this is undoubtedly a demographic that's slightly biased towards younger people. But let's put Google's market share at 10%, which to me seems absurdly low. That would be 1.6 million users that we've essentially surveyed for 30 days.
He searched Google using Arabic, figuring that's a better tool to measure what locals are interested in. He started by typing in Tunis, the capital of Tunisia, to see how many Egyptians were following the demonstrations there. He compared the number of Google searches for Tunis with the number of Google searches for pop stars in Egypt.
Typically, as I think you would find in the United States, pop stars kind of trump almost any search that you can think of. But actually, the searches for Tunis prior to the demonstrations that really kind of kicked off in late January were surprisingly high.
So how would intelligence agencies use this kind of information to supplement more traditional methods? Again, Colonel Reed Sawyer.
Imagine in Washington, D.C., when the debate was happening about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood.
When the revolution unfolded in Egypt, there were concerns in the U.S. intelligence community that the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic political group, might come to power.
If the decision makers could have understood how little the Muslim Brotherhood was animating the online searches inside of Egypt and the quest for information that the population had, how it might have led to different decisions or different discussions, at least, that were being held in the halls of Washington.
In other words, few seemed interested enough in Muslim Brotherhood to search for them on Google. Still, Google Trends can't predict the future, but it could be one more tool for intelligence officials who want to tap into the private conversations that could spark popular movements. Dina Temple-Raston, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Imagine waking up on New Year's Day at 6:15 a.m. The night before was pretty wild. You're not feeling so great. So you hobble into the bathroom to wash your face and brush your teeth. The year is 2100, and this is how your morning might unfold.
Leaving the bathroom, you wrap some wires around your head, which allow you to telepathically control your home. You mentally raise the temperature of the apartment, turn on some soothing music, tell the robotic cook in your kitchen to make breakfast and brew some coffee. And you also order your magnetic car to leave the garage and be ready to pick you up. As you enter the kitchen, you see the mechanical arms of the robotic cook preparing eggs just the way you like them.
According to physicist Michio Kaku, that's his voice you just heard, all the technology for that scenario exists. It exists now. And he's written about it in his new book that lays out what to expect over the next 100 years. It's called Physics of the Future. And he says, brace yourself for everything from telepathically fried eggs to invisibility cloaks to a doubling of your lifespan to contact lenses that will enable us to
have the internet in our eyeball. We're talking about blinking and you are online.
So it would be like inserting a colored contact lens, except it's going to be the internet in that contact lens.
And think of what you can do. When you meet somebody, your contact lens will identify who that person is, print out their biography next to that person's image, and then translate from Chinese into English or whatever as the person is speaking.
The printed material will come out from our ears, or?
No, right in your contact lens.
Remember
the movie Terminator, where Arnold Schwarzenegger sees a person? Immediately you see the description who that person is. Well, in the future, you will have it. You will know exactly who you're talking to, what they are saying in any language as they are saying it. And we have prototypes of this today. This is not science fiction.
This is something that people are really working on. The scientist is really working on it.
People are really working on it. The Pentagon is working on it. They have a version of it where your contact lens lays out the whole battlefield.
You're a physicist. You're a bona fide physicist, a well-respected physicist. People know who you are. Explain to me how somebody will be able to invent an invisibility cloak, which you write about in the book. Doesn't that defy the laws of physics?
I teach optics at the university, and for years I used to teach the kids that invisibility was not possible.
Yeah.
Well, I was wrong. And so is every single physics textbook on the planet Earth wrong. When light hits you, light cannot wrap around your body and reform at the other end. Light cannot do that.
Right.
But scientists discovered a new substance called metamaterials, which allows that very fact. Light then wraps around your body, reforms at the other end as if you don't exist. Now, remember that the Pentagon has spent hundreds of millions of dollars perfecting stealth technology.
Right.
And these airplanes are visible. It's that under radar, it's hard to see. It has the image of a large bird. So this is the real McCoy. This is the Harry Potter invisibility cloak. Now, we're not going to have it for several decades, but the basic principles have been proven in the laboratory. Every physics textbook on the planet Earth is now being rewritten.
I'm speaking with Michio Kaku. He's the author of the new book called Physics of the Future. He's also a professor of physics at the City University of New York and the host of the Sci-Fi Science program on the Science Channel. Michio Kaku, you write that within 100 years, we will view chemotherapy as a treatment for cancer similarly to the way we view leeches of the last centuries.
That's right. What killed George Washington? You might be shocked to realize that George Washington was bled to death.
Right.
That's how he
yes.
died. Because back in those days, that was medicine, leeches and bloodletting. In the future, we'll view chemotherapy the same way. Because we will create smart bombs that knock out cancer cells individually. And believe it or not, we have them already. In trial tests, up to 90% of cancer cells can be zapped by nanoparticles. This is going to be big. Real big. Take a molecule, for example,
right.
Very tiny. And cancer cells have large holes, pores in their surface, raggedy large holes. Ordinary cells have smaller round holes, not these raggedy holes. Let's say you create a molecule that's in between the two.
Okay.
That means it cannot get into a normal cell, but slips right into a cancer cell.
Wow.
This is going to change everything. And how will you detect cancer? By going to the bathroom and using your toilet. We have things called DNA chips that are so accurate, using tiny transistor-like things, we can pick up individual cancer cells, one out of a billion. In fact, Mass General Hospital in Boston, in 3 years' time, may begin to market these things on the market.
They already exist.
Everything in the book already exists. I am not a science fiction writer. I am a physicist. And we already have nanoparticles that can zero in on a cancer cell. They've been tested and proven.
Now, I know you're a physicist and you're not an ethicist. I'm not saying you're not an ethical guy, because I know you are. I've talked to you before. But if there are microchips or chips embedded in our toilets and in the mirrors of our homes and in our bodies, what about our privacy? What about our ability to be individuals? I mean, it seems, and I hesitate to use it, but it seems Big Brotherish.
Well, you know, when the internet was first created, it really might have become a Big Brother. But in 1989, something happened which changed world history. With the breakup of the Soviet bloc, the National Science Foundation decided to give the internet away for free. That changed human history because it meant that a force of democracy was given to the peoples of the world. And also, when faced with new inventions like this, people are a little bit afraid. But just remember that when electricity was first harnessed by Thomas Edison, people were very afraid of electricity. They thought it was intrusive. It's going to go right into your living room. People will be electrocuted and houses will burn down. That's what the critics said. Well, you know something? The critics were absolutely right on every single point. Houses burn down every day because of electricity. Yes, people get electrocuted in their living rooms every day. Yes, electricity is everywhere. And you know something? We love it. So many of the inventions that I talk about in this book, some people may feel, that's a little scary, right? But hey, you get used to it. And then later you say to yourself, how could I have lived without it?
That's Michio Kaku. He's a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York. His new book is called Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny in Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100. Michio Kaku, thank you so much.
Been a real pleasure.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What if our gadgets were, well, a little more sensitive? What if they knew that we were getting frustrated or mad or even tired, and they could tailor our experience, whether it's shopping online or driving our cars? They could tailor those experiences to suit our mood, maybe make us a little happier. Or if your car knew your driving habits so well that it could sense when you were getting angry, and it could intervene, sort of like a built-in road rage-o-meter. and keep you from doing something stupid on the highway. Well, scientists at MIT are working on devices, including webcams and special wristbands, that help measure emotions in people. The data they collect might help us make better communicators or drivers. Or maybe the devices could one day help people with emotional or physical problems, like autism, communicate their feelings and needs better to us. What do you think? Would you want your computer or a wristband to track your emotions and learn about them and maybe interact better with you or maybe take care of you? Or you think that's an invasion of your privacy? Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let me introduce my guest. Rosalind Picard is Director of Effective Computing Research and Director of Autism and Communication Technology at the MIT Media Lab. She's also Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT and co-founder and chief scientist at Affectiva. That company is Affectiva Incorporated. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Picard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Can you describe exactly what emotion sensing is and how our emotions are sensed?
Well, first of all, what we're sensing is some outwardly measurable aspects of emotion, which is not quite the same as knowing what you're really feeling inside. For example, we can, using a camera, recognize your facial expressions. And if you choose to show that you're frustrated or angry or smiling and pleased, then the camera can start to interpret that information and hopefully respond respectfully like a person hopefully would. We can also put a sensor on if you choose. It's all opt-in. And from the surface of your skin, pick up some changes that are happening inside your body. And those can be indicative of some aspects of your emotions changing as well.
What kind of changes would it sense?
Well, the main one that our sensor picks up on now is the electrodermal activity. That's small changes in conductance sensed from the surface of your skin. And those are activated when your sympathetic nervous system, sometimes known as the fight-or-flight system in your brain, is activated. So when that fires, it affects the innervation of the nerves around the sweat glands under the skin. And even before you sweat, we can pick up those changes.
How different or similar is this to what is being sensed on polygraph tests?
This is one of the signals used in polygraph tests, but it doesn't just change with lying. For example, it can go up with things that you're positively excited about, like getting ready to meet somebody very special to you. It can go up.
Mm-hmm. And you work with the idea that we might be able to get our machines, which they all have computer chips in them right now, of course, to be able to interact with us better and understand our emotions or things that we're feeling. And you're also looking at it for possibly helping out kids with autism.
Yeah, there are a lot of people for whom our technology is actually useful right now, while the general emotional intelligence machine still kind of has a ways to go. But right now we have people who are wearing our sensors, say, who are unable to speak and unable to talk about their feelings. Mm-hmm. And people are kind of trying to guess what's going on by looking at them on the outside, and that's extremely inaccurate. And while the sensor is not a perfect readout of your emotions, it does tell you some changes that you can't always see accurately on the outside, and those can be really valuable.
Mm-hmm. When you take these measurements, how many do you, how do you calibrate the machine? What's the process that goes on here?
We actually don't have to do any lengthy calibration. You can just put the sensor on and see the level, and then watch how it changes within a person. So when a person's relaxed, it goes down. When they get excited about something, it goes up. So it's pretty easy. Now, people may have different absolute levels, but it's very easy to adjust for those by just looking at them over the course of the day.
Is it easier to tell when someone's getting angry or getting happy?
Interesting. Usually we would look at the face for that. If you're getting really happy, both could be activating for our sensor, anger and happiness. And hopefully the face would tell you if it was positive or negative. However, we just presented some results at a conference I met in California showing that sometimes when people are frustrated, they respond with a happy smile. And that may be a coping mechanism. So it's important to look not just at the smile and not just at the autonomic response.
I've seen commercials recently for automobiles that will detect when you're falling asleep or avoid oncoming objects if you're a little drowsy. Mm-hmm. Is this that same kind of idea here, at least in that frame reference?
We haven't focused on driver drowsiness, but the same kinds of signals could be used for that, yes. So you could look at things like, are the eyes closing? Is the head falling forward? Is the person's muscle tone kind of fading? And is the skin response, which also shows very interesting patterns during sleep, changing in a way that looks like the person's falling asleep?
Do you find that people are eager to use this, or do they see this perhaps as an invasion of their privacy?
Well, I mean, if somebody forces this on you, I would see it, you know, as an invasion of privacy.
Right.
But our technology is all designed to be opt-in, and you can wear it or not. You can turn your camera on or not. So I would certainly not force this on anybody. I think what we find is a lot of people are very curious about what's going on inside themselves, and they want to try it. And when they see it, they learn things, and that's really helpful to them. So, you know, if you want to learn about yourself, then you know, give it a try. You can keep the data private, or you can share it with others if you feel you trust them.
And if we wanted to try this, how could we do that?
Well, I'm delighted to say the sensors we've invented at MIT no longer have to be sent out with a grad student and a soldering iron attached. Now, Affectiva is selling them. If you go to affectiva.com, you can learn more about them or mail info@affectiva.com. They are providing the sensors primarily right now for researchers, and we are planning to come out with a consumer version later in the year.
Let's go to Mary in Cincinnati. Hi, Mary. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually like to sing in my car when I'm driving. And, you know, like if it's something that I really enjoy, I might get into it. And I'm wondering if someone were to be singing like an angry song or an emotional song, if the software that you're talking about, you know, interpreting our driving and changing the way our car responds, if that might have a negative, you know, impact or reaction if we're, you know, enjoying the music.
I certainly think we should be very wary of how we have the car respond differently to us in our affective states. Some of the things people have done that I thought were really smart were, for example, if your GPS is talking to you and you're angry, then it better not sound cheery, right? The voice might want to change its tone to be more subdued. On the other hand, if you're, like, really happy, singing, you know, cheery, and the voice reflects that, then it's been shown people actually drive more safely when that voice responds, becoming more cheery when they're cheery or becoming more subdued when they're angry. So that I would see as something that would, you know, improve our performance behind the wheel, and that I would welcome.
That's interesting. Thanks for calling, Mary. Happy singing.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm sure it's disco music. Let me ask you a question, Dr. Picard. If your car, let's take this car example because I think it's fascinating. If your car discovers that you're angry, might it speak up like a friend would say, and warn you to calm down a bit, or, you know, you might be on the brink of road rage here, soothing, something like that?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think there's going to be an interaction with personality. If it did that and you didn't like it, it had better not keep doing that, because that could make you angrier, and that would make you a less safe driver. I've been told by others that anger equals 3 beers behind the wheel of a car. If you're really angry, don't hop in the car. Do something else for a while. And whatever it takes to get you to calm down would be what we would want to learn how to do to support you if that happened in the car.
Mm-hmm. So you might actually, though, opt in to choose something like that to warn you.
Yeah. If you have a problem, like we're working with people who struggle with emotion dysregulation, whether it's anxiety attacks or panic attacks or cravings that precede substance abuse, and if we can measure that pattern unique to them and understand how to help support them at that moment, then we can, through the mobile device, actually bring them a response to their sensed data that is hopefully helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine this would be useful in a shopping situation where
there are a lot of companies interested in shopping. I know now that we're completely mobile and you can just wear this in regular life, you know, you go in the store and you can see, you know, what makes your signal go up, and usually it's bad stuff. Usually it's something like, you know, one of those frustrating checkout machines that's not, you know, not making sense.
So it detects that you're sitting there frustrated online because the person has 15 items in the 10-item line, and maybe it knows that and it offers you a coupon.
Yeah, actually, we've been looking at ways that, you know, people might be Well, some people just intrinsically want to learn about their data. Other people might be, you know, a little reluctant, like, why would I turn on my camera on the web, you know, when I'm shopping? But if it's just like them looking at you in the store and they give you a coupon, you know, at checkout, why not turn on your camera and let them see that you're confused by the screen that they're showing you at the checkout mm-hmm. section?
Yeah, or if you're, you know, you have one of those electronic carts now that have all these TV screens on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it could detect and then offer you something on that screen or point you to a sale that's going on in the store or something like that.
I'm sorry? What do we do with sales?
Or it could point you to something on sale to make you a little happier, offer you something.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we can easily detect smiles of delight, people walking in and out and looking at things. And certainly if you give people an unexpected surprise that's delightful, they can feel really good about that experience and want to come back and even want to tell others about it.
Yeah, thank you very much for telling us about it.
Well, thank you. My pleasure.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Take care.
Rosalind Picard is Director of Effective Computing Research and Director of Autism and Communication Technology at that famous MIT Media Lab. She is also Professor of Media Arts and Sciences at MIT and co-founder and chief scientist at Affectiva Incorporated. And she says you can actually experience this for yourself. If you want to find out more about it, you can go to their website and see what it's like to have that kind of interaction. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk with Lawrence Krauss. Dr. Krauss will be here to talk about his new book, which is The Life and Times of Richard Feynman. And you can call us, 1-800-989-8255. The book is called Quantum Man. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. We'll be talking about one of the most interesting physicists of the 20th century. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Say you're zooming down the highway when you spot one of those speed limit enforcement cameras from the corner of your eye. You hit the brakes, but not before the camera's flash catches you breaking the law. A speeding ticket is surely on its way to your mailbox. Now, imagine that same camera also snaps a photo of your car when you're driving at or under the speed limit. And for your safe driving, you're entered in a lottery to win a portion of the money from the fines paid by speeders. That idea was tested in Sweden with great success. It's an example of something called gamification, considered the next wave of social engagement and internet technology. Gabe Zickerman is here to explain it all. He's the chair of the Gamification Summit and Workshops. He's co-author of the book Game-Based Marketing, and he's at the NPR studio in New York. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you very much.
What's your definition of gamification?
Well, gamification really is the process of using game thinking and game mechanics to engage users and solve problems. It's an interesting idea that's based on really the last sort of 25 or 30 years of trends in technology and society that's coming to a head now because we're looking for new answers to some very, very serious and intractable problems both in business and society that possibly gamification is best suited to solve.
Okay, let's take that speed camera example from Sweden. How does gamification apply there?
It actually turns the whole idea of speeding, fines, and penalties on its head in a way that only game people think of. Speeding fines are normally what we think of as a huge outsized penalty with no reward. And we can think about many systems in life which are designed that way. Think of, you know, generally the legal system. So instead of being structured around, you know, all this punishment and negativity, speed camera lottery is all about positive reinforcement. If you go under the speed limit or at it, you might win some money. And that positive incentive to create better behavior is a core tenet of games. Hmm. Games are not about punishment. Games are about reward and pleasure.
Hmm. There's also, I think you write on your gamification blog about positive incentives helping people lose weight and get in shape. What's an example of how it works?
Well, one of the best examples, I think, in society is The Biggest Loser. We take an activity which is normally thought of as private and very, very embarrassing, which is I'm overweight and I want to lose some weight, and we make that public. We put a lot of pressure on the user. We give them a nominal reward, but the big one that works really well is the fame, and we put them through this ringer, and they tend to lose a bunch of weight. Now, what's interesting about Biggest Loser and other gamified examples of weight loss is they hew to a model that I've developed for user rewards called SAPS. And SAPS stands for status, access, power, and stuff. And that's the order of things that people want in their lives as rewards. It turns out that cash isn't that good of a reward. Status is a fantastic motivator for getting people to do stuff.
You know, I imagine that this makes a lot of sense to younger generations. How do you make gamification appealing to the older generations?
Well, broadly speaking, you know, games are actually very appealing to older people today. I'll tell you a funny story. We were called in to a company that works with investors. They were giving investors badges for various levels of achievement, things like bull, bear, pig, whale, shark. These are all terms that the finance industry uses to describe a particular kind of investor or market situation, right? You've probably heard these terms before. But they actually assigned little icons to the people. So you logged into the system from one day to the next, and all of a sudden there's a cutesy little whale on your page. It says, congratulations, you're now an investing whale. And they just started getting a ton of angry calls from their mostly white 50-something rich male audience. These people do want to be known as whales. They just don't want to be cheapened by looking at a whale. So the example that I gave them for how to fix that was, instead of actually using, you know, literally those images of whales, bulls, bears, and so on, they should have just changed the color of people's profiles to gold, platinum, and black, which everybody immediately recognizes as the American Express card levels, which are considered more universal for a 50-something white male rich audience.
Gabe Zickerman is co-author of the book Game-Based Marketing. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
The retail price of the new iPad 2 starts at around $500, but hackers have found a way to create a similar device with a slightly smaller screen for about half the price. As John Kalish reports, they are turning e-book readers into tablets running the Android operating system.
The Amazon Kindle has 3G data connectivity so that readers can download books anywhere there's cell service. Many Kindle owners realize that the device can connect to Google and Wikipedia to look up things mentioned in their ebooks. San Francisco hacker Mitch Altman doesn't read ebooks on his Kindle at all. He only uses its web browser to access maps and restaurant listings when he's traveling.
This is something that's starting to get around in geek and hacker circles, and it's a relatively cheap way to have internet anywhere you go.
When Altman says it's cheap, he's referring to the fact that the 3G Kindle costs a mere $190, and there's no charge for the 3G internet. Of course, there is a trade-off here. The Kindle doesn't have a touch screen, so you have to use scrolling buttons to navigate around the screen, which Altman has found cumbersome. But for $60 more, he could have gotten the Nook Color.
Introducing Nook Color. Experience millions of books like never before.
The Nook Color is one of Barnes & Noble's ebook readers. It sells for $250 and can only access the internet via Wi-Fi. It runs a stripped-down version of the Android operating system.
Books, magazines, newspapers, and children's books all at your fingertips. Nook Color by Barnes & Noble.
Alex Kuklinski is a college student in Omaha, Nebraska.
Hey everyone. In this video, I'm going to show you how you can root your Nook Color so you can make it into a full-blown Android tablet.
Kuklinski posts videos almost every week on YouTube where he goes by the name Husker Mania. He's quite fond of the Nook Color and its high-end touchscreen.
It's a really high-quality device for the price.
Kuklinski says the procedure for converting the Nook Color into an Android tablet is relatively simple. It takes about a half hour, and the only cost involved is the purchase of a micro SD card, which can run about $15. Otherwise, it involves downloading a piece of free software that includes the Android operating system.
I was nervous at first. I was really nervous that I was going to basically ruin something. But once I did it, I realized how easy it was.
That's the theme music used for a series of videos on theunlocker.com, a website devoted to the notion that consumers can get more out of their mobile devices if they unlock or root them. David Kogan runs the site. He compared a Nook running Android to the Samsung Galaxy Tab, another Android device, and found the Nook stacked up well.
It's a little slower. There are occasional glitches. You know, sometimes things don't appear correctly on the screen in certain applications. If you're just using it to surf the internet, use some apps, play Angry Birds, etc., it works pretty well. And the thing I like about it is that it's very lightweight and very thin, even more so than, say, the Galaxy Tab.
Kogan credits a huge community of software developers for driving innovation in the hacking of smartphones and tablets. And though the crowd that is inclined to root something like a Nook e-reader is relatively geeky, Kogan says that crowd is growing.
People are going to realize that they can get a very inexpensive Android tablet with this device. And the developers see that, and it's a challenge to them, and they're going to continue to make it better. So it's definitely going to get more stable, less glitches as time goes on. We're talking weeks, days.
Barnes & Noble declined to comment on the use of its Nook Color ebook reader as an Android tablet. The terms of service for the device make it clear that rooting voids the warranty. But recent talk in the tech blogosphere indicates that the company may soon issue a software update that will make the Nook more of a tablet without hacking it. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
And this is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Leah Scarpelli and produced by Sarah Lucy Oliver, Kimberly Adams, Elaine Heinzman, Walter Ray Watson, Laura Krantz, Justin O'Neill, Thomas Dreisbach, Rebecca Paris, and Tinbeat Ermias. Our technical directors are Burke Hahn and Melissa Marquis. The librarian is Kim Oleski. Melissa Goh is our web producer. Today's show was produced by Peter Breslow and edited by Tony Marcano. The senior producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. I'm Leanne Hansen.